willing him to come back with all my might. And so, dear Angie, it is with a heavy heart that I go to bed tonight. Perhaps tomorrow will come, and he will be at my door, although as every day passes, that chance seems to get smaller and smaller, like a distant star gradually dying to a tiny, unfathomable glimmer of a memory. I will write again soon. Venetia.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Thursday, the 8th of August, 1940. I've taken to going round to Chilbury Manor every morning to see Venetia. She's not at all well, still terrifically pale and weak from the blood loss. Anyone can see she's heartbroken. She hardly says a word without crying and turns away most food, although Mrs. Winthrop is turning the county over to get her favourite meats and fruits. I worry that she will lose the pregnancy, although I sometimes wonder whether... Well, I expect we shall see how things work out. Mrs. Winthrop had a word with me as I left today, telling me that Henry had been to see Venetia. He is on leave and with the RAF out every day, fighting and fatalities growing. I can only imagine his purpose. "Did he ask her to marry him?" I asked. "No, but I think he may do so. Obviously he knows little about Slater and nothing about the baby." "Will she accept?" "I'm not sure." She looked at me long and hard. "She knows she's in a bind. She swears that Slater loves her, but where the devil is he?" Back at home that evening, after we'd finished dinner and washed the dishes, I came to sit in the front room with the Colonel for a cup of tea while he was reading the paper. I sat close to him, waiting for him to pause so that I could talk. In the end, he smiled and looked up. "I know you're watching me," he laughed gently. "What is it that you want?"
"I need to ask you a question," I said, thinking it best to be as direct as possible. "I need to know about Mr. Slater. I have a feeling that you know what happened to him."
He glanced over the paper at me, then turned the page noisily, making a big deal about folding the pages straight. "Now you know I can't tell you that kind of thing, Mrs. Tilling," he said calmly.
"Yes, but I really wonder if you might be able to break that. Just this once, just a little. You see, there's a young woman who is completely heartbroken on his account, and she is now on the brink of accepting an engagement from another." I paused, wondering how I could put it to best effect. "I know you can't tell me, but if you could, perhaps, give me some small indication as to whether he is alive, that would be very helpful."
"Well, I can't, I'm afraid." He went back to studying his paper as if completely absorbed.
"Or perhaps you could simply turn the page of the newspaper if he is alive." It was a chance. I was desperate.
He sat contemplating this for a few minutes, then turned the page of his paper.
"And is he in prison, or in some way unable to get to her?"
This time the page turned quickly, his eyes still glued to the text.
"So she shouldn't be marrying this other chap, then?"
At this, he pulled the newspaper down onto his lap and looked straight at me. "If Slater is alive, it's because he is lucky. One day he will die, or land up in some prison somewhere. She stands a better chance at happiness with this other fellow, if you ask me."
"But she's not in love with him. She's in love with Slater."
"Well, it stands against all reason. He's not the type of fellow one should fall in love with." He pulled up the newspaper again, giving it a hard shake to straighten the pages, then resumed his reading. "We can't all choose who we fall in love with," I said, rather annoyed at his insensitivity. He pulled down the paper and looked at me for a moment, suddenly thoughtful, then replied, "You're right." I poured out the tea.
"So should I tell her to wait for him?"
"That depends on how much time she has," he said quietly. then added as an afterthought, and how much pain she'll go through when he puts his life at risk again and again and again until he finally loses it. And that's all I could get out of him. He utterly refused to tell me anything else, even though I tried my most conniving methods. What a stubborn man. I began pondering other ways I could find out more about Slater, and remembered Carrington, who also works in that department now. Perhaps he could find out about Slater for me. He, of all people, would know that I'm trustworthy. I called his number, even though it was getting late.
Parnamas,
pronounced the officious tones of the butler. I'd like to speak to Lieutenant Carrington, please, I said, trying to keep my voice confident and firm. He is not available. It is a bit of an emergency, I said quickly. There was a pause and a small cough. I shall inquire. Whom shall I say is calling? Mrs. Margaret Tilling. From Chilbury. A minute later I heard the soft upper-class tones of Carrington whispering in the echoey room. Hello there. He seemed pleased to speak to me, which was a good sign. Hope you survived the Chilbury bombs all right. I did, but a friend of mine is in a spot of trouble. It is a matter of the heart. I was wondering if you could use your connections at Lichfield Park to find out about someone.
I'll try, he said quickly. Can't promise anything. Who is the person?
A Mr. Alistair Slater. Could be a black marketeer, could be caught and in prison, could be dead, but almost certainly is known by your lot. I just wanted to know his story, whether my friend should hold out for him or not.
Yes, quite agree. I'll be on to it straight away, he said cheerfully,
obviously disguising the nature of our conversation. Then he paused and I heard voices in the background.
Look here, he whispered. I'm afraid I have to leave now. But I know what you're after, and I'll ask a few questions and telephone if I find anything. Cheerio!
And he was off the line. The Colonel came downstairs and eyed me suspiciously, so I picked up my duster and gave the telephone a quick dust, beaming a cheerful little smile at him.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Thursday, 8th of August, 1940. The Money. This morning, Sylvie and I went to have a look at the massive pile of broken buildings in the village square. Lots of people have started digging through it, some helpfully trying to find the things of the people who live there, but most are looters, stealing anything they can find. Much to our surprise, we found Tom there. Hands on hips, he was standing on top of a heap of debris, dirty as a bandit. "I'm trying to find an envelope of money," he said in hushed tones as we climbed up beside him. "Miss Poultry asked me to find it for her. She says she hid it under her floorboards." "Well, you're looking in the wrong place," I told him sternly. "Miss Poultry's house was next to Hattie's over here." I led him to the right spot, and then we climbed around and started looking for the envelope. I was longing to find it so that I could be a hero like Venetia. And finally I did, holding it high in the air and calling over to Tom, "Here it is!" Of course everyone looked round, some coming forward to see. Ralph Gibbs was there, watching the fat envelope.
"Do you know how much money is in there?"
"Don't know," Tom said, and much to my annoyance, he snatched it away and shoved it down the front of his shorts of all the horrid places. "Come on, Kitty, let's go." "But I'm the new hero." He grabbed my hand rather roughly and dragged me away, Sylvie running behind. We sprinted down the lane and across the fields to the hop pickers' huts, dashing into Dom's and shutting the door behind us. Laughing, we opened the envelope and took out all the money. All the money! There was so much of it. Where did she get it from? "I don't know," Tom whispered. "Come on, let's have a party," I said, getting to my feet. "I'll go and see if the farmhands in the barn have some biscuits or milk."
"I'll come too," Tom said. "Look after the money, Sylvie." Off we ran, Tom beating me by a fraction, although I hadn't been racing at all.
But the place was deserted, and after a spot of searching, we quickly realised there wasn't anything to be had. I was just checking one last corner when Tom decided to grab me around the waist, pulling me to him and planting a rather soggy kiss right on my lips. "Stop! Stop!" I yelled, thrusting him away. "Don't you know I'm engaged to be married?" "No, are you?" He laughed in a disbelieving way, wiping his mouth. Sylvie was suddenly there, innocently inquiring, "What are you doing?" "Nothing, Sylvie." I took her arm and walked to the door. "We couldn't find any biscuits, so we'll have to go without, won't we, Tom?" He came up beside us and took my other arm, grinning in an annoying way, and we strode back to the huts. When we got back, Tom's door was hanging open, squeaking as it swung to and fro. "Sylvie, did you bring the envelope?" Tom said. She shook her head, unable to speak. We ran inside to check for the money, but I think we already knew. It was gone. There was no sign of anyone, but we looked at each other, knowing who must have followed us. Sylvie and I went sulkily back home, leaving Tom to work out what he was going to say to Miss Poultry. "Well, at least it wasn't our money," I said as we rounded the wood. "Why didn't you kiss Tom?" Sylvie asked. "He's nice." I stopped dead in my tracks. "I am engaged to Henry, Sylvie. I can't go around kissing hop-picker boys, can I?" How could she possibly think otherwise?
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Thursday, the 8th of August, 1940. Dear Angela, a dull feeling of dread lurched in the pit of my stomach when I woke up this morning, as if I knew how the day would evolve, what events would take place, what decisions would be made. The doorbell rang at 10, and I wasn't surprised when Mama knocked on my door to tell me that Henry had come again. I knew straight away that I wanted everything to be different from yesterday. I didn't want his sympathy, or his comments on me looking, how did he put it, lost. So I put on my yellow sundress to make me look more cheerful and brush my hair until it shone golden. I wanted him to treat me the same as he'd always done, as if nothing had changed, as if everything were exactly the same as it had been 6 months ago. And I was the undisputed empress of the village. I looked at myself in the mirror and put on my old red lipstick, feeling encouraged by the transformation. Isn't it extraordinary how one can look like an empress, yet feel like a frail shadow? He was sitting on the same sofa as the other day, immaculate in his uniform. I tried to make an entrance, like I would have done before all of this, swinging my yellow skirt so that it cascaded around the doorframe, raising my hand alluringly up to my hair, jeering loudly. "Oh, Henry, I see you simply couldn't stay away." But it all felt a little flat and over-rehearsed. He stood up and stiffened, although still smiling in a polite way. Henry is always polite. I can't work out whether it's adorable or tedious. I stopped swishing my skirts and struggled to work out what my approach should be. I was self-conscious, wanting him to adore me as he always has done, yet not really wanting him to. I'm sorry if this doesn't make sense, Angie. I confess, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. I really don't know what to think anymore.
"How are you today?"
he asked, coming and taking my arm and leading me over to a chair, as if I were an invalid. "I'm fine, Henry," I muttered, lifting his hand away and standing beside the sofa. "Look, let's please not talk about me today. I'd much rather hear about you and your plane and how many dogfights you've won." I looked up at him beseechingly, and he gazed at me for a moment. And then he smiled gently, tilting his head slightly to one side. Then he lowered himself down on one knee. I froze. I'm not exactly sure what I had been expecting from this meeting, and I knew that Daddy felt certain that Henry would come running if only I said the word. But I didn't feel so sure anymore. I didn't feel so sure about anything. Why would I be suddenly interested in his marriage proposal had not something happened that had made me more eager, more in need of it? Why did he suddenly think he stood a chance? Was he walking the tightrope between being the best of friends, helping in a bad time, offering support and love, or being a man who sees an opportunity, a weakness,
and seizes the moment.
"Venetia, my darling,"
he said, taking my hands in his, pressing them lightly, with the merest suggestion of urgency.
"Please let me take you away from this and encompass you with all the love and happiness that I have in my heart."
He smiled in such a wonderful, warm way, his eyes caressing mine with hope and happiness. My eyes began to water, and a tear spilled out and down my cheek. If only I could love this man, I thought. If only I'd never met Alistair, never known what real love was. But then I wouldn't be in the state I was in now. I'd be the old Venetia, and there's no damn way I'd be settling for Henry Brampton Boyd.
"Will you do me the honour, Venetia, of accepting my hand in marriage?"
he asked in a half-whisper, taking my hands to his lips.
"I have a wonderful life to offer you, with the heavenly Brampton Hall, a very comfortable living, and, not the least I hope, my very dear and enduring love for you."
A series of pictures flickered through my mind in quick succession. A heavily pregnant shadow being hidden away in her parents' house, and then swept into a nasty nunnery. Her beloved baby snatched from her grasping arms, never to be seen again. I couldn't bear the thought of giving up my baby. I knew that this was my alternative. I was being given a way out, a brutal compromise between two sacrifices, and I knew how I had to act. "Yes," I uttered, hearing my words as if spoken by another, more practical Venetia, a Venetia who wanted an easy life, with wealth and status and legitimate children, living in the grand Brampton Hall in the style to which she had grown accustomed. A Venetia who always looked at her eldest child with regret and guilt, sliding uncomfortably together in a swell of discontentment. Could this Venetia be me? I took my hands away and sat down, using all my force to stop myself from crying, steadily putting a smile on my face, keeping my chin up, facing the music. And I realized that this is what it's like to be an adult, learning to pick from a lot of bad choices and do the best you can with that dreadful compromise. Learning to smile, to put your best foot forward, when the world around you seems to have collapsed in its entirety, become a place of isolation, a sepia photograph of its former illusion. I stiffened as he sat down on the sofa beside me, shifting over a fraction. I rearranged my yellow skirt, scared of what was coming next. I saw his face come towards mine, and worked hard to prevent myself from shrinking away. He gently placed his lips on mine and, although the world didn't stop turning, it was not unpleasant. He has vastly improved his kissing since the orchard experience, which had been rather wet and gagging. It was a gentle kiss, no pressure, no passion, nothing like the kisses I shared with Alistair, which were torrid, fervent episodes. It couldn't have been more different.
"My love," he said,
and it sounded so odd coming from his lips.
"This is the happiest day of my life."
He smiled and looked sincerely overjoyed. I managed to smile, trying to mirror his joy in my face and my bearing. It was extremely awkward.
"We will need to set the date soon,"
he whispered, leaning into my ear, kissing my neck, my throat.
"I don't know how long I can bear the wait."
"No, let's not wait too long," I agreed, with frail enthusiasm, wondering how long I could hide the pregnancy. "The sooner the better."
"So we're agreed,"
he exclaimed, slapping his hands on his knees with pleasure.
"I will tell my group captain as soon as I return to base. They should be able to give me a few days off later in the month."
He took my hand and brought it to his lips, kissing first the back of my hand and then turning it over, opening up my fingers and kissing inside. The room was closing in on me, clammy and stifling, and I felt like leaping up, throwing open the veranda doors and letting myself run down the lawn, escaping down into the valley like a wild horse, and on forever. And I knew that it would always be that way. I would spend the rest of my life running. "Let's tell Mama," I cried, snatching my hand back and heading for the door. "I can't wait to see her face." I strode out into the hall, and he followed me, as I went up the grand staircase, clutching the sweeping banister with every step, desperate for some kind of reprieve. We found Mama in the nursery with Sylvie, helping her mend a doll's dress, carefully showing her how to backstitch to make it stronger, the way she had with Kitty and me when we were girls, so very long ago. "Mama!" I called, breathless from the door. "We are to be married!" She got up, a look of panic quickly turning into a smile as Henry came in beside me. "Oh, that's good," she said, rushing to open a window and letting in a fresh breeze. She took a great breath of air, then turned and came over to give Henry a kiss on the cheek. "I'm so very pleased." She looked me straight in the eyes, only 7 or 8 inches from mine, and her mouth said, "I'm sure you'll be the talk of the village." But her eyes looked as if they were about to be crushed by a ton of black, heavy coal. I know she's never been happy with Daddy, was forced to marry him for the sake of her family. The weight of all those years were packed into that look. She wanted me to do the right thing, but she couldn't help but think of herself, the loveless, persecuted life she'd led. She looked back round to Sylvie, her new protégé, and then she said to Henry, "You must go straight away and tell your mother. She'll be furious if she finds out she wasn't the first to know. Venetia, you must stay here and discuss plans."
"You're right. She'll be livid. You know how she is,"
he chortled in his good-humoured way, and I found myself already disliking him.
"So, my darling,"
he took my hand again,
"I'll bid you goodbye and come again this afternoon. Maybe we can go for a long walk together and make some plans. The wedding, the honeymoon."
His eyes sparkled, darting uncontrollably over my body. He disappeared out with alacrity, and we stood in silence, listening to his footsteps down the marble stairs, echoing through the hallway, and then the massive dull clunk of the front door being slammed. Then, silence. I crumpled. Mama helped me to the nursing chair, and Sylvie was sent out to get some tea.
"I had to do it, Mama," I whimpered. "You know I did."
She didn't say anything, just a long, quiet shh, as if she had learnt that the troubles of the world could be absorbed and deafened out by slow, steady wishfulness. And I suddenly understood that she'd been silencing out the noise for the past 20 years. Sylvie returned with some tea, and we sipped quietly, talking about how things were going to be. Weddings happen with great pace these days, which one must see as a blessing under the circumstances. Although we exchanged withering looks at the prospect that it might even be as soon as next week. "Of course, you may wish to, well, consummate the marriage before the event, so to speak," Mama said in a bit of a hurry, rather embarrassed. I must have looked at her as if she'd lost her mind, as she quickly added, "so that he doesn't doubt the parentage of the baby." She smiled at Sylvie, who was looking especially alert, and I couldn't believe that either of them was keeping up the ridiculous charade that Sylvie doesn't know exactly what's going on and how it had come about. After a while, I dragged myself out of the comfort of the nursery and headed down to my room, where you find me now. My mind is going round in circles. Why am I here? What was I thinking? Why is this the best choice? Surely there are alternatives. And where is he? Where is Alistair? Doesn't he hear my pain expanding exponentially through the universe, covering multitudes of galaxies with a never-ending scream? Where is he? I sat at my dressing table and took out the pendant, wishing on it that he would arrive, like a knight in shining armor, and whisk me away. Or that I would wake up and find it was all a horrid dream, happening to a different Venetia, on a different planet, somewhere high, high above us, in the brutal, dispassionate universe. I will write soon. Much love, Venetia.
Letter from Miss Edwina Pawtry to her sister Clara. Lichfield Hospital, Lichfield, Kent. Thursday, 8th of August, 1940. Dear Clara, what a day! First of all, the stupid boy came in to tell me he lost my money. I cannot believe I entrusted my fortune to such an incompetent idiot. He found it, took it to his hut, and then someone ruddy well stole it. He thinks it was Ralph Gibbs, so I'll be having words with him when I'm out of this place. Next, there I was, lying in the lumpy hospital bed, when in jaunts the tilling woman, her beady eyes on me as she strode down the ward, a bright and shiny new look of determination about her. She was all fitted and buttoned up in a navy blue coat I'd never seen on her before, a far cry from the baggy old grey thing she usually wears, and carrying a brown leather handbag that looked like it could give someone a nasty bruise if she took a good swing at them. "Enjoying your break?" she chirped in her sing-song way, putting on a forced, unfriendly smile, the one you might see on a magistrate's face just before he finds you guilty. "Nice to put your feet up, isn't it?" She patted my leg, and I winced at the thought of how much pain she could inflict should the mood take her. I thanked the Lord that she was such a wimp, although I have to say that she's not the downtrodden widow any longer. This war has given her a real boost. You can tell by the way she holds herself. More upright now, none of the slouching shoulders and moping face. Well, once she was always running little steps to keep up, now there's a purpose to her stride, like she's more worthy than the rest of us, doing more, giving up more for this war, for our community, and we'd better show a little respect. "Oh, Mrs. Tilling, what a lovely surprise!" I pulled out my syrupy smile. "How good of you to visit poor little me, wrecked up in hospital! I was just thinking that you were the only person decent and kind enough to come." "Well," she sighed, "I actually came to ask you a few questions about the day the two babies were born." I kept a calm smile glued on my face, but I never dreamt she'd jump to the chase like that. "I'll be glad to help you there. Quite a day it was." I took a sip of water from the glass beside my bed for sustenance. She pulled up a chair, sitting her narrow behind on the edge. "I've been thinking," she began, in an ominously lowered voice, "how strange it was that both babies appear to have had the same breathing problem that required resuscitation at your house, no less." "Yes, it was a very trying day, but one has to do one's best. You see, these things are a lot more common than you think. It was fortunate I had the correct apparatus. It's incredible how 10 years of experience can mean the difference between life and..." A pause, creasing up my eyes for effect. "Death." "How very fortunate that you were there," she said, raising a skinny eyebrow. "Although perhaps if you hadn't been, the babies would have stayed with their rightful mothers." All I could think was, "We're done for!" But then a nauseating little smile touched her lips, and I could see that she thought she'd won. And of all the things I am, Clara, I am not a loser. So I pulled myself together and did a spot of clever thinking. For her to just come out and say it means she thinks she can scare me into an admission, and she ain't getting no admission out of me, no matter how close to the truth she gets. "What can you mean?" I smiled. "Only that having both babies in your house at the same time would have made it possible for you to have swapped them. You could have given the boy baby to Mrs. Winthrop and the girl to Hattie." "What a preposterous suggestion!" I sputtered, feeling my voice cracking a little. I decided to try to laugh it off, make her sound like the crazy one. "How could you dream up such a monstrous idea, Mrs. Tilling? Have you lost your mind?" I shook my head in a disgusted way. "I didn't dream it up, Miss Pawtry." She looked directly into my eyes, her voice calm and collected, a judge revealing the final sentence. "The facts led me to believe it to be true." I took a deep breath, searching for some facts of my own. Then I remembered. "Both of the mothers already knew the sex of their babies before I took them away. They'd been delighted. I'd been so pleased. Why would I have needed to do such a terrible thing?" "Neither of the women actually saw her child close up before you whisked it away, Miss Pawtry." Her voice was mellowing, like an overripe plum, lowering in tone, gaining confidence. both told me that the only reason they knew the sex of their baby was because you had announced it. Oh, now, don't be putting ideas together from different stories. I know you're just upset because you weren't there, but it can't be helped. She leant forward, and her eyes bored into me. And that's when she came out with the one thing I would never have imagined she knew. You made a deal with the Brigadier, didn't you? I was scared. If she knew the Brigadier was involved and let him know that she knew, then I'd be dead meat. What are you talking about? I know you met him the night of the bomb, and I have a good idea of the information you're attempting to sell. I gazed up at her with shock. How could she have known that? There'd be no one around, I swear on it, just me and the Brigadier alone. We just happened to cross paths, had a chat about the trains. The delays are appalling. Wasn't it a little late for you to be catching a train? Something inside me snapped. What right had this stupid woman to walk in here and pester me with accusations? In any case, my nicey-nicey approach wasn't getting me anywhere. I was just a sitting duck for her. I needed to get her out of here. I can catch a train whenever I like, Mrs. Tilling, I glowered, my voice rising. I sat up more straight, adjusting my leg on the bed. How dare you come in here and start accusing me of these ridiculous crimes? How dare you, of all people, a nurse? You should know to let a convalescing person stay quiet and calm. She sat poised, watching my gathering annoyance, a serene calm on her face. It was the moment I saw Venetia with baby Rose in her arms that I knew, she said, showing off how clever she'd been to work it all out, just like bleeding Miss Marple. The baby looked so very like her. Venetia could have been her mother. She looked at me, an eyebrow tentatively raised. Or her sister. God damn that baby and that wretched girl! If she weren't so beautiful, no one would have noticed a thing. I felt trapped, like a weasel in a poke hole. With a sudden burst of ingenuity, I knew exactly how I could smash her little intimidation to smithereens. I reached for the glass jug next to my bed and shouted as loud as I could, "Nurse! Nurse!" And with a tiny laugh, I let the jug slip from my fingers, sending it tumbling to the cold tiled floor. A colossal crash broke the silence as 1,000 splinters of glass soared into the air before cascading down, silvering the floor, the beds, the furniture, with a delicate crust of icy glitter. It would take hours to clean. The nurses came rushing over, dashing here and there with brooms and mops, moving Mrs. Tilling out of the way, taking the chair, changing my blanket, reassuring me that everything was going to be all right. I tried to look dishevelled and innocent, nodding to the nurses apologetically. When I peeked over to Mrs. Tilling, she was standing away from the bed, hands clasping her bag, fury on her frowning face. She remained smouldering from afar until a nurse went and had a word with her, fetched her navy coat and led her to the door. Her long face turned to me as she was marched off, annoyance in her eyes and perhaps a ghost of the Mrs. Tilling of old, being pushed and shoved around again. Only this time she wasn't happy about it. She wanted her own way now. I felt a chill over the back of my neck as the door swung shut behind her. But what would she do next? My first thought, of course, was that she could try to blackmail me, extract some kind of reward for her silence. Thing is, it's not the Tilling woman's style. She has enough money for her practical little lifestyle. She would be more likely to do something for morality or decency or some equally nauseating reason. She has a sickening desire to be an upstanding member of the community, and this little victory could perch her on a new throne. Of course, there is a chance she could do us all an almighty big favour and let the whole thing go. Why should she bother taking it further, after all? She has no proof. Her precious Hattie is now dead. Mrs. Winthrop is overjoyed with her boy. Swapping the baby's back is not in anyone's interest. It would just break up their little community and cause more trouble than it's worth. Everyone would hate her. She's not such a fool that she doesn't know that. Which brings me back to my final, most alarming outcome. She might go and blab to the Brigadier. Tell him I betrayed him. Use it to get power in this little place. And the Brigadier will come in and break my bleeding neck, as he promised to do if anyone found out.
Lord, I feel like a trapped fox with the hound circling. I made sure they moved my bed next to the nurse to be on the safe side, and just as I was settling in, who should walk in but Elsie? All fancy in a green floral dress and looking pretty as a young swan until she opened her gob.
I heard it off Kitty that a lad was looking for your money.
She leaned close.
And I know some of that is rightfully mine.
Don't threaten me, my girl, I said. In any case, I ain't got no money. It's gone. It was found and then stolen. If you want money, you need to look elsewhere. She tidied her hair, preening.
I got that in mind too, she said. Got a plan to get a rich husband. Need little pocket money, see? Make myself look the lady.
I gave a snort of a laugh. You'll have to do better than look good if you want to get a knob.
I'll show you, she sniffed. But I need cash, and I know things about you that'll make you cough up.
I was getting cross. Elsie, I haven't got any money to give you.
Well, where's the money gone then?
Tom thinks it was Ralph Gibbs. If you want to let him know, I want it back. I was angry now. It's my money, and he ruddy well knows it. A thoughtful look came over her beautiful complexion. Her lips twisted.
Well, best be off then, she said.
A resolution clearly made, probably to go and snatch it off him herself. And with that she pranced out, a confident smirk on her wide mouth like she'd swallowed a toad. I rolled my head back on the pillow and groaned. That's all I needed. Another person in search of my money. As well as the telling woman and the brigadier after me. You'd better burn this letter, Clara, and the rest, in case the old you-know-who gets wind of it. You never know which walls have ears these days. Edwina?
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Thursday, 8th of August, 1940. What not to do? I heard about Venetia and Henry. Sylvie told me, running up to the stables to find me. "There's news," she called as she saw me in the stable-yard saddling up Amadeus, who started shuffling away nervously. "What news?" "Venetia is going to marry Henry," she panted, coming up next to me, an intense expression on her face. "She said yes." "What?" "Henry asked Venetia to marry him, and she said yes," she repeated, her face creased with worry. "She can't," I said matter-of-factly. "She's pregnant with Slater's baby." "I know. That's why she's marrying him." "That's not fair," I said, struggling with the enormity of it all. "Poor Henry. Won't he find out? Won't it all have to be called off?" "I don't know," she answered, coming up beside me. "But why would he ask her to marry him when he's engaged to marry me?" "Maybe he forgot," she said softly. "He likes Venetia a lot, Kitty. He always wants to talk to her." I turned and screamed at her. "You don't know what you're talking about!" She ran faster than I've ever seen her go, and I was left stroking Amadeus, convincing myself she was mistaken, that this was just some ludicrous joke. "Come on, Amadeus," I whispered into his neck. "Let's go for a ride." Once I had climbed onto his back and sat above my surroundings, looking over the green and gold patchwork of countryside, I felt more at ease to consider the possibility of Sylvie's news. Reasons why Venetia can't marry Henry. She's in love with Mr. Slater. She's pregnant with Mr. Slater's baby. Henry's supposed to marry me. It simply wasn't the way things were meant to be. When I look into the future, I always see Henry and me living at the Hall with 4 children, 3 cats and a big dog called Mozart. I don't see Venetia there. She wouldn't suit living in Brampton Hall. I don't think she aims to have quite so many children, and she doesn't even like dogs or Mozart. It just wouldn't work. I trotted Amadeus down the path and broke him into a racing gallop over the pasture. I wasn't really thinking about which way I was going, but it didn't surprise me when I found myself in front of Brampton Hall, the sprawling red-brick Gothic-style mansion gleaming in the brilliant sunlight. It was built a few generations ago by the original Brampton trader who got rich in India. Now they're a grand local family, with Mrs. B. determined to make them grander. It was Henry himself who came to the door when I rang, looking rather flustered, and I remembered that all their servants had left. "Henry!" I beamed. "Kitty, nice to see you. I thought you might like to go for a walk." He glanced back into the house. "All right, let me just tell Mama." He left the door open and strode off. I returned to Amadeus. "You see, he's not engaged to Venetia. Sylvie was wrong." He reappeared and off we went, walking up the path to the lane while he hastily buttoned his collar and smoothed his hair. I was on foot, running slightly to keep up with his long strides, Amadeus trotting beside me. We quickly reached the lane with steep grassy banks up each side and the sky blue and cloudless above us. "I'm afraid I can't walk for long today, Kitty," he started. "You see, I have some wonderful news." "Oh, about the war?" I asked, feeling the earth beneath me uncertain like a tremoring earthquake waiting to rupture open the ground. "No." He looked at me with a grin. "I suppose I need not keep it from you, of all people. Venetia has made me the happiest man in the world by agreeing to marry me." I stopped, rooted to the spot, terrified. "It's true," I uttered, the sunshine piercing a blinding light into my eyes. It's true?" "Yes." He stopped and turned to me. "Did you already hear about it?" "I say, you're right, Kitty." I looked up at him. "But we were supposed to be married, Henry," I cried out. "You said we would be married once I was old enough. You said so." Tears had begun forming fat, pointless fingers of water that rushed down my cheeks. Henry looked horrified.
"But Kitty," he said quietly, "I never said that."
"When?
Where?"
"By the river on the picnic to Box Hill. You said if I helped you find Venetia, you'd marry me."
"Did I really? What a dreadful thing to say. I'm so sorry, Kitty. It must have been a misunderstanding or a joke or, well, something."
He spread out his hands and a short, embarrassed laugh escaped him.
"But now you'll be my sister and I'll be your brother and that'll be even better than being married, won't it?"
"No, it won't," I shouted. "I don't want you to be my stupid brother, even if you do end up marrying my sister, which I doubt very much."
"What do you mean?"
"She's pregnant with Slater's baby," I yelled into his face, spit flying out of my mouth with every word. He took a step back, his face empty, looking at me.
"Now, Kitty, you shouldn't joke about things like that."
"Just go and ask her. She's in love with him. She wants his child, but he's disappeared, so she has to take you instead."
His shoulders fell forward and his eyes grew hollow, and like a mirror of horror, I saw my utter distress pass from me to him, coursing out of me like a thick jet of yellow and black and surging into his body with a flood of rage and despair. He sat back on the grassy bank, his knees up before him and his head in his hands, murmuring something to himself.
I stood and watched him for a while, my hero deflating before my eyes, and I began to sense the enormity of what I had just done.
"Go away, Kitty,"
he said quietly, calmly, not looking up at me. "Henry, I'm sorry,
I'll say thank you for telling me, and now leave."
He raised his head, his eyes suddenly angry and wild. "But Henry..."
"Stay away from me,"
he snarled under his breath, getting up and standing above me.
"If I told you what I'd like to do with you right now, you'd wish you'd never met me. Now go. Leave."
He was shouting, threatening. I could never imagine he could be like this, his beautiful blue eyes turning black like a fury of snakes. I grabbed hold of Amadeus's reins and ran, sobs heaving uncontrollably from my mouth, feeling like the end of the world had truly come. Once I was back in the dark, shadowy stable, I laid an old horse blanket on the floor in the corner and curled up on it as tight as a shell. I stayed there sobbing, Amadeus nudging me with his soft nose in sympathy. Why had I done this? Why had he done this? A few hours later, I heard the sound of a small voice behind me. It was Sylvie peering into the shadows. "What do you want?" I demanded. I have sandwiches, she said in her quiet voice. Put them on the bench outside. Everyone is looking for you, she said. I didn't say anything, just let the words flow in and be absorbed. Of course Daddy will be furious. He wanted Venetia to marry Henry. It had all fit into place. Venetia staying in bed, Daddy trying to talk to her, Mama trying to negotiate, Venetia changing her mind about Henry and agreeing to marry him, Mama weeping late into the night. And next? Daddy will surely kill me, if Venetia doesn't get to me first. Thank you for the sandwiches, I said quietly to Sylvie, remembering that she was now my only ally. She backed away into the dusk, unsure whether I was a wise choice of friend. It was night before I went back to the house, cold and hungry, shivering with fear. The pantry door was left unlocked for me, and someone had left a roll in the bread bin. I scooped it up and crept up the back stairs into my bedroom, which is where you find me now, dear diary. The house is in silence. I had anticipated the family waiting for me, everyone shouting, everyone crying. But this stillness is somehow more disturbing. I think that tonight, when it's past midnight and everyone is asleep, I shall pack a few things together and vanish.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Thursday, the 8th of August, 1940. Dear Angela, I write again, this time to tell you that the engagement is dramatically off. I can only thank God for a narrow escape. How was I to know that Henry Brampton Boyd could be such a monster? I feel numb and exhausted, and the whole business has given me a fever. I am to stay in bed, which I confess I am more than happy to do. It was with mixed feelings that I heard his arrival early afternoon. He hadn't been due to come back until late afternoon. Mama had insisted that I needed to rest, and I was looking forward to a chance to recover from the whole ordeal. But abruptly, at around one, I heard the bell pull hard, and then again, and the sound of raised voices rang through the hallway, my name being called, shouted. I knew that something had happened. I knew he must have found out. I took a deep breath, smoothed down my yellow dress, and padded out onto the landing overlooking the hall, where I could see him looking up at me, red-faced and furious, his fists clenched, his fair hair dishevelled, his uniform open at the neck, skewed and fraught. "Venetia!" he yelled. I've never known Henry to be angry, but not in a thousand years would I have imagined him as ferocious, as crazed, as he was then. He's always been so gentle, so dignified. It was like seeing a Labrador transformed into a wolf. I walked down the great staircase slowly, holding my breath, praying for this encounter to be over quickly. "I need to have a word with you, my girl," he said, under his breath, grabbing my arm and dragging me into the drawing room, where he closed the door so that Mama, who had been hovering in the alcove, couldn't follow. As it happened, it made no difference, as she could hear every word out in the hallway. I never knew he could raise his voice to such a level. The whole house vibrated with his bellowing, the crystal chandeliers thrumming in his wake.
"Now tell me,"
he demanded, shoving me down on the sofa, standing over me raging.
"Are you pregnant?"
I nodded slowly. To be honest, Angie, I was so done in by the entire drama that I simply couldn't find the energy to fight back. I was petrified of him, in a way I would never have thought possible, and frankly overwhelmed with relief that he was going to break it off, that I would be free, whatever burdens I knew this would entail. I knew then, at that moment, that I was strong enough to get through this, with or without my family's support.
"Yes, Henry," I said louder. "I am." "What?"
he roared, his whole face red and contorted with rage.
"You were going to marry me, knowing that you had another man's child inside you."
"I'm sorry, Henry. It was a mistake. I can see that now."
"Did you really feel you could get away with this?"
He stood over me,
looking down threateningly. "I don't know," I said plainly, looking at my hands. "I thought it would be for the best, but now I see I was wrong. We could have been married. We could have gone for years without me ever knowing. I wonder when exactly someone might have informed me. Had not Kitty told me this morning?" "It was Kitty," I said quietly. "Of course it was Kitty. She's in love with him. She was using the only card she had left. Yet I couldn't help feeling rather pleased she did it. Proud of her, almost, in an odd kind of way. Although this was probably due to my immense relief that someone told him and put an end to this dreadful charade. I can't believe I'd let myself think it was the best thing to do."
"Is that all you have to say? Oh, it was Kitty, as if you don't care at all. I'm glad you know," I said stiffly. "Are you feeling some sense of remorse?" he said sarcastically.
He sat beside me and leaned over, his face right in front of mine, threatening and vengeful.
"Did you discover that deep down you may even have a conscience?"
"I suppose I do," I said uneasily. "I felt that the whole thing was wrong."
"Oh!" He stood up with a start. "The lady realizes that getting married while pregnant with another's child is wrong. Well, well, Venetia."
He laughed sarcastically.
"Now I think of it, that was half of your attraction. Your lack of conscience. Your complete, unremitting self-absorption. I wonder now how I never saw through it before. You're nothing but an empty shell, Venetia. A beautiful girl without a soul."
He strode over to the veranda doors, looking out over the fading wisteria and broken cobbles, then added quietly almost to himself, "I'm glad I finally see you as you really are." There was a gap, a silence, where I should have said something, defended myself, apologized, soothed him. But I didn't. Alistair had shown me that I was a flesh-and-blood human, more than the facade Henry thought he knew. Everything he said was irrelevant. He didn't know me now. Perhaps he had never known me. I was only angry with myself for agreeing to marry him in the first place, silently wishing this entire ordeal were over. I was aching all over. My head was throbbing, and I felt the chill of an invisible wind whisking through the room behind my neck, under my hair.
"But Venetia!"
He turned, his voice different, now pleading, a sorrowful yearning.
"Why did you do this to me? You know how much I love you. We've known each other all our lives. Why did you do it?"
Waves of nausea began rippling over me.
"I thought it might be all right, Henry. I never meant to hurt you. I thought I was doing you a favor, marrying you. I know you've always wanted that. I know it wasn't perfect, but I thought I'd get over the past, begin again. I'd get pregnant quickly. No one would know the baby wasn't yours. Lots of people do it."
"But we aren't lots of people," he roared, storming towards me. "I am an individual, Venetia. Sometimes I wonder if you've ever realized that."
He sat down on the sofa next to me.
"Look at me, Venetia. Take a good, long look at me."
His voice was firm, abrupt, and he looked straight into my eyes as I raised them to his. He looked different from every other time I'd seen him. Open, alive, as if bringing everything he had left to this moment.
"Yes, I know," I murmured.
As his eyes met mine, they altered, relaxing, narrowing. His rage replaced by hunger.
"Venetia, I want you so badly. I almost wanted to ignore the baby and continue with the wedding. I tried to push it to the back of my mind, but I could never live with that. I hate Kitty for telling me. If she hadn't come and ruined it all, it would have been perfect. I would have been the happiest man on earth. You would have been mine."
His eyes swept down over my body, and his hand moved to my waist.
"You would have been mine,"
he repeated, his hands moving fast, running up and down my side, his thick, clumsy fingers grappling over my thighs. I was calling for him to stop, trying to get his hands off me, but he carried on yelling,
Is this the kind of girl you are, Venetia? Is this what you like?
I realized that I needed to get out, so I used all my force to push him away, standing up to flee from the room. Only he regained balance fast and strode after me, his hand slapping my face so hard that I fell to the floor with an almighty bang. Then Mama was there, standing over me, screaming, "What's going on? What on earth are you doing?" He promptly stopped and began to smooth down his hair.
"I think you should leave now, Henry," Mama said briskly, feeling my forehead and helping me up.
He pursed his lips in annoyance.
"Yes, I've had enough of her now,"
he said with meaning, and strode out of the room haughtily. Mama's sad eyes caught mine as we listened for the second time that day to his footsteps, hard against the marble hall, the voice of the maid showing him out. The great thud as the front door slammed, sending a shower of tiny dust particles slowly rippling through the air like a vanished apparition being laid to rest. I began to cry. The pain in my body was immense, and my head was pounding. Mama helped me upstairs, and I collapsed on the bed. I slept for a while, and then I heard Daddy shouting downstairs. Mama, who was sitting beside my bed, quietly got up and turned the key in the door. I knew she was scared for me, far more scared than I was. He can come for all I care. I know that I can cope with his temper. I know I can cope with anything. I am completely numb. And that's where you find me now, Angie. Sitting in bed, trying to make head or tail of this whole miserable mess. Mama says I have a fever, and I confess I feel incredibly tired, so I must leave you here and get some rest. Venetia.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Friday the 9th of August, 1940. What a sad night this has been. It was past midnight when Kitty scratched on the front door. The Colonel answered and came up to get me, and I opened my bedroom door in Harold's old brown dressing gown and pattered down to find out what was afoot. "Something's very wrong with Venetia, and I think you need to go to the manor," she said quietly, adding with a vague tremor, "and may I stay here for a while, please?" I told Kitty she could have the small room, and hurried back into my bedroom to throw on some clothes and grab my nurse's bag before darting out into the night. I ran all the way to the lane, stumbling over twice as my thin torch roved over the uneven path ahead of me. At the manor, I let myself in the side door and headed up the back stairs, stopping to catch my breath for a few moments before knocking. My main dread, that Venetia was having a miscarriage, was confirmed as I entered the room. It was a tragic scene. In the dim mauve light of her bedside lamp, I saw Venetia sprawled in pain, weeping that she'd never forgive herself. There was a lot of blood and a strong smell of plasma. Mrs. Winthrop was dashing around with towels and cloths. I sat next to Venetia on the bed and spoke quietly to her, gauging what she was going through, what needed to be done, whether we should take her to the hospital. It was early in her pregnancy, so at least she wasn't going through labour. And slowly, throughout the early hours of morning, the entirety of her pregnancy was gradually ejected from her frail body. "Is she going to be all right?" Mrs. Winthrop asked. "Yes," I said, although inside I couldn't be certain. She was underweight, exhausted and traumatised. She was running a fever and had lost a lot of blood. "There was a scene with Henry," she went on. "He found out about the pregnancy and hit her. She fell hard on the floor." I put my arm around her as we sat down beside the bed. Henry's explosion must have been the last straw, after the blood loss, the weakness, the heartache. We watched her in silence, and I was relieved when the situation began to stabilize around dawn, and she fell into a light sleep. "Go to bed now, and get a few hours' sleep, as I'll have to leave at 8, I whispered to Mrs. Winthrop. "I'm far too awake to sleep," she said. "But I'll make us some tea." I stayed quietly monitoring Venetia's fever, while Mrs. Winthrop crept in and out, bringing tea and a vase of purple hydrangeas from the garden. She opened the curtains a few inches as the sun rose over the wheat-clad hills, allowing a pastel amber stream to flicker into the room.